So last time we talked about these convolutional neural networks, and I wanted to just show you a few websites or tools that I think are useful for helping to visualize what's happening, because here this kind of two-dimensional structure that we're exploiting is really important. And I just think, you know, it's kind of hard to draw those on the blackboard, and some of these pictures and animations online I think can really kind of help with understanding what's going on. So today in tutorial, we're gonna be exploring these convolutional networks. And just if you're feeling that you're a little unsure of exactly what's going on, because in the code we're gonna see, it's just gonna be a call to one of these PyTorch functions. I just thought I'd show you these, and I've posted a page of references on the portal now too. So you'll be able to find these here. I would just encourage you to look a little bit to just understand a little bit more. So first here, just this small first section here of this this GitHub README file, it kind of accompanies a paper that's linked there. They just show you what's happening as I kind of use these different filters to glide across my input image. So the blue here would be my input image. They show kind of what it means to have different padding, different strides, etc. And what happens as I take that into the next layer of the network. And then, you know, we talked about these different kernels or filters that we would apply to an image. And so we're often going to be using these to study spin systems, but these networks are often also used to study images. And so this is just another really nice online tool that kind of shows you the effect you can have on images when you apply different types of filters. So here's an example. This filter can sharpen images in general. You can go choose different ones. There'll be different little matrices here. And when you walk through, it's going to show you, like, I can move my mouse and highlight different pixels. It shows you exactly how the input is corresponding to the output, how it's using that filter to do that. So I just wanted to show these because I think it's sometimes helpful to have these visual guides to see what's going on. So that was just a quick thing I wanted to share. And then today we're actually going to change to talking about unsupervised learning. We've so far in this class been talking about supervised learning. But before that, I wanted to revisit a couple of questions that came up last time, kind of looked into some of these answers. So first, there was a really good question about whether dropout is used in convolutional neural networks. This was a really great question because CNNs are kind of exploiting a certain structure. And so does dropout work in the same way? So it turns out you can use it, but it's in general less effective for these convolutional layers than it would be in these fully connected feed-forward networks. But there's some modified versions of this that tend to be more effective. I won't talk about them in detail, but I'll just kind of give you some keywords. In general, they tend to be referred to as structured dropout methods that kind of impose, just as CNNs are imposing a bit of structure, you can impose some structure in dropout. And one example, there's lots of methods that do this, but one that gave some nice summaries and explanations is a paper on a method that was called drop block. This is by some researchers at Google. I'll just put the paper in case anyone wants to look at that. Okay, then there was another question about whether convolutional networks can be used as these universal function approximators, as you can for the feed-forward networks. So it turns out that you can. Of course, these proofs of how you can do this, they kind of work in different ways. Sometimes what you're trying to prove is that if you have a network with enough neurons in it that you can do this approximation, whereas other times you're talking about how much depth, how many layers you would need. So there is a proof in a paper again, you can read more about this. There's maybe other cases where there's a proof as well, but this is just one in particular. Specifically, there's a paper that talks about how these CNNs can approximate any function if you're willing to look at any number of layers. And so okay, and the last question. I think it was probably mostly resolved by the end, but there was a question of exactly what feature maps mean. And what I seem to get a consensus when I looked at a few different places that it's the output from one filter, which I think is what, or sorry, it's the output from a layer that's going to feed into the next layer, but it's specifically the output from one filter. So we could apply many, you know, we can have many different filters, many of these small patches that we're applying. And a feature map is going to be the output that we get from one of those. Okay, so again, this was kind of just summarizing last lecture. So now we're going to kind of shift topics. So I just want to see if there's any remaining questions on CNNs before we kind of move on to unsupervised learning. Yeah?
I guess I've never understood why it's called convolutional. It's based on what we talked about, like where did the convolution?
Yeah, I guess like you can, I haven't really written it in terms of a convolution in the expression I've given you, but if you look it up, then you can express this operation in terms of a convolution. The way that it's applying these patches everywhere. Yeah. A lot of references will do that.
I guess it kind of makes sense if you think about like a convolutional integral, like, you know, the function you convolve with is always like translation invariant two, right? And kind of integrate that over. Not precise, but that would be like my intuition, I guess.
Like capturing the same symmetries.
Yeah, like you're, I don't know, just like integrating over something with one function and applying that locally everywhere. Yeah,
if you, I can, in the references page that I posted, there's a lot of references that talk about CNN specifically, and I know a lot of them like show that more formally. I'll find one and I'll just send that to you guys. But yeah, it's in one of, I mean, I'm sure it's in many of those references that I posted, yeah. Any other questions? Okay, great. So let's talk about unsupervised learning. So does anyone remember kind of what's specifically different about unsupervised learning compared to the methods that we've seen so far?
You don't have labels.
Yeah, exactly. No labels, yeah. So we're trying to learn some kind of properties, but of a data set that doesn't have labels. So we don't have our data in pairs of x, y anymore. It's just some set of points x. And each of those data points can have n components. And our data set is going to have some number of samples of those points, each of which has n components. So we're specifically going to talk about two specific classes of unsupervised learning. The first is called dimensional reduction. This is going to be what we talk about today, also next lecture, and this is what you'll look at in the next homework. So the idea here, as you might be able to tell from the title, we're trying to reduce the dimensionality somehow of our data set. So if we start with data that has n components, we'd like to see if we can find the most important features or correlations that are within those components of our data set, so that we can express it in lower dimensions. And as you might be able to imagine, if we were able to reduce specifically a large dimensional data set down to only two or three dimensions, then we could easily visualize our data set. So even if we're just thinking about trying to have an easier way to visualize our data, in a lot of cases when we do this, for certain data sets, our data will form some kind of clusters in this lower dimensional representation and maybe show us about different underlying features in our data set. And then there's also clustering methods that we can apply directly, but in some of the cases that we're going to look at, we'll even just see that by eye, we can learn some kind of structure by going to lower dimensions. So let me show you specifically what you might see, or the idea that you might see in homework two. So if I plot this in some lower dimensional representation, you might be able to identify three clusters, one being for paramagnetic, corresponding to the paramagnetic regime. And then usually with these methods, we won't get one ferromagnetic cluster, but we'll get one corresponding to mostly up and one corresponding to mostly down. And again, I'm not going to talk about this too much now because this is what you're going to do on homework too. You guys have any questions? We're going to talk about specifically a specific algorithm that does this in a minute, but I just wanted to give you the general idea for now. Okay. And another class of unsupervised learning that we're going to look at is generative modeling. That's going to be some lectures that Mohammed is going to give next week. And I'm sure that Juan and Roger are going to talk about this in their guest lectures as well, although I don't know exactly what they're going to talk about yet, so I'm not going to say for sure, but I would expect they're going to talk about this. And also, for those of you that might still be around next year, we're going to have a follow-up course to this one, another machine learning course, and a lot of it will talk about some of these generative modeling methods in more detail. So there's going to be more details next week, and then even more details next year. For now, I'm just going to write one sentence about this, and just know that more is coming. So the idea here is that we would take our data points, we would try to learn about the probability distribution of this data in different ways, and also generate some new samples from this probability distribution that we learn. Okay, so now I want to also say a few more things about unsupervised learning in general. It turns out that we can actually kind of write a formal relationship between unsupervised learning problems and supervised learning problems. So let me kind of write these definitions maybe just in a different way. So you'll remember that for unsupervised learning, my data set has no labels. For supervised learning, it has labels. We've said, in unsupervised learning, we're trying to learn the probability distribution P of X. And something I haven't said, but I haven't said explicitly, but we could phrase the goal of supervised learning that we're trying to learn the probability distribution of the labels conditioned on the data points. So I'm going to show you these problems are not actually formally different because I can use a chain rule. Imagine I have data points with n components, then I could write this probability distribution like this, and I could keep applying this kind of chain rule. And I could arrive at an expression like this. So if I write it like this, we see that an unsupervised learning problem can be written as n minus 1 supervised learning problems plus this additional problem of this p of x1. But that one is a lot easier than learning learning for all of these components. And in, for example, some of the systems we'll consider, that one we would just know by symmetry. In a lot of these systems, if I have a bit of knowledge about the symmetry of the system, for example, if I was looking at an icing model, I would expect that in general, I'm equally likely to find an upspin or a downspin. So I would just know this is a half. So then I've really reduced this to n minus 1 supervised learning problems.
I'm using this dimension that I discarded as label, something like that.
Which dimension? So no, not yet. Sorry. So let me. I was talking here about different classes of unsupervised learning, dimensional reduction, generative modeling. We're not talking about dimensional reduction yet. That's going to be next. But before we get into that, I just wanted to show you kind of how you can relate these problems. This is actually not what we're going to do in dimensional reduction. We're going to do something else, but it's just I just think it's just something interesting to see that, like, in general, you could do this if you wanted to, that there's a relationship between these models. We tend to think of them in two classes, but this is just a way that you can relate the two.
I feel when you write like this, then saying that unsupervised learning has no labels slightly makes sense, but a priori to this, I would think there are only labels there. Means instead of saying there are no labels, instead of saying x, y, and we are removing y, I would say because we are finding the probability distribution that is governing those data points. So it's like we have only labels. You're trying to find what probability distribution generates that.
Mm. That's interesting.
Thinking, because what you're doing is trying, like you wrote, you're there, you're trying to learn the probability distribution mm-hmm. of p of x.
Yeah.
So, and here you're trying to learn the probability distribution of y and given some data points you have. So
yeah.
So y means if you are calling y label in supervised learning case, then x should be called label in unsupervised. But
well, I'm not calling it a label, but I see what you're saying. Like you're saying that because of where this is in this expression,
yeah,
it kind of looks like it's a label.
Yeah. But maybe
yeah, I think that's like again, I think I mean, this is kind of a question of terminology. Like, what do we call a label? What do we not? I think you're right. I think the way you're phrasing it, I could re-explain everything and say that I only have labels or something like that. This is kind of the way that people tend to refer to it. But yeah, no, this is a really interesting point you're bringing up that, you know, maybe I can reformulate the way I state these classes of problems in different ways. Yeah, I think that's interesting. But I think, again, yeah, so I'm saying here they're not formally different, but just remember that the way, and again, still what you're saying holds true. I'm not countering it. I'm just saying in the end of the day, we're going to have a class of algorithms for unsupervised learning, a class for supervised learning. The actual algorithm that we're using is going to depend on whether it's supervised or unsupervised. So in supervised, we're going to use those labels to help us adjust our cost functions and the weights and parameters in our network, right? And the way we do that is specific to the fact that we have labels, and we're going to see in unsupervised learning, we don't have that in the same way. But right now, I'm kind of talking about how to phrase one problem in terms of the other. But once we decide which approach we're going to be using, then I think the approaches are different, and there maybe like the sense of whether you call it a label or not makes more sense. But I think it's an interesting point. It would be cool to just think of exactly the right way to say it in this new way of thinking. That's neat. Yeah. And so, and I just also wanted to say that we can also write supervised problem as unsupervised problems. Okay, so again, and I would also say some methods we're going to look at are going to exploit relationships like this in different ways. I think another point I just wanted to bring up from some of the questions that have come up, I think, you know, formally when I'm thinking about unsupervised learning versus supervised, at least in a lot of the cases we're going to look at, we're going to be thinking of the label as quite different from the data points. You know, in the example we've looked at, the data point is some set of spin configurations, but Y is not a set of nothing to do, I shouldn't say nothing, but it's not an up or down spin, it's like something labeling the phase. It's really kind of a different type of information. This is just a way to show that I can kind of massage that data set into a new form, but still, I might start out thinking of it as an unsupervised problem and then kind of reshape it into this supervised problem if I wanted to. Okay. So now let's specifically talk about this class of this class of tasks that we might want to do dimensional reduction. And today we're specifically going to talk about a method called principal component analysis, but then we'll talk about another method on Monday. So just as when we were talking about supervised learning, we talked about something that was linear to start, linear regression to start out with. We're also going to start by talking about a method that involves applying some kind of linear transformation to go to this lower dimensional representation. Let me just show you, you know, this is not always going to be successful, but let me show you an example of a case where it would be successful. So often we're going to look at cases where our starting data set has very high dimensions, but just so I can draw it, let me show you a case where I would start with two dimensions and I would try to go down to one dimension. So imagine that my data points look something like this. Then we could see that this pink line here would be a good fit to our data. And I could say, so in this case, these two directions are highly linearly correlated. So this is an example where PCA could be useful to help me identify this linear direction that's most important to describing my data. And of course, this is not always going to work. It's specifically designed to find these linear correlations. So I just want to emphasize that some data sets will need more sophisticated methods that still maybe dimensional reduction can do something in some form, but it can't be PCA because we need to go beyond these linear transformations. So let me just introduce some notation, which I think we've seen similar notation before, but let's just talk about it again. As we've seen before, we have to think about both the number of data points we have and the dimensions. So let's store all of that in one matrix. We're going to store it like this. And this PCA algorithm is going to require that the mean of our data points is zero. So we're just going to shift it so that it'll satisfy that condition. So just to write it explicitly in terms of the each data point, but also in this matrix notation, we're just going to shift it. I've used this C to indicate that it's centered. The C is to denote a centering operation. Thank you. Okay, and then now I'm going to introduce another matrix. So this is a matrix that's going to store the variance and covariance of the components of my data points. So now, again, I'm kind of just setting up notation so far, but I'm defining this matrix V, where the diagonal components are going to store the variance of all of the components 1 through n, and the off-diagonal elements will store the covariances. So now I can kind of restate the goal of PCA in terms of this new notation. So the goal is to apply some linear transformation to my data that's stored in this XC, so that in this new representation X prime, this matrix V is diagonal, so that I've eliminated these linear correlations between the different components in this new representation.
Why is the factor of m minus 1?
That's how you define like variance and covariance, right? It's actually, in the end, we're not even going to care about that because we just are going to be looking for something diagonal. But that's kind of a factor that's defined like the variance of a data set.
But how is that interpretation different to saying I'm just finding the eigenvalues?
It is going to be an eigenvalue problem in the end. Yeah. Any other questions? So I've now kind of introduced this new matrix P. So now we're actually going to, within this matrix, see what it means to have principal components. Thank you. So this matrix P is going to kind of tell me what linear transformation I have to do to my original data set to get these new directions. So when this matrix is diagonal, I'm going to be able to
there is no m minus 1 there.
Sorry?
The m minus 1 goes in the definition of Vx itself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I see what you're saying. Oh, yeah, thank you. Yeah. Yeah. Here. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Thanks. And in any case, it doesn't matter because all I care about is that it's diagonal. So, but yeah, thank you. I should correct that. Thanks. And so because this matrix V that I'm trying to diagonize is symmetric, I can write the eigenvectors as being orthogonal so that the transpose is just the inverse here. And then I really do have this in terms of an eigenvalue problem. Now I'm just trying to think if that, I think this m minus 1 is still here. Also, because this matrix is symmetric, all the eigenvalues will be positive here. Okay. And now, let's just sort these components and these eigenvectors so that I have like this. Now, I'm going to say that the principal component corresponding to this first eigenvalue is called my first principal component. So now this component is going to correspond to the direction with highest variance. And the last thing I'll do, and I'll just say a little bit more next time. So cases where PCA is useful are going to be cases where the first few components are large compared to the ones that follow, so that these eigenvalues quickly die off. In this case, limiting ourselves to only those first few components in this new representation is going to still represent our data well. So to say that really concretely, if those eigenvalues get small very quickly, then we do expect that if we limit ourselves to the first few principal components, then this lower representation is still going to represent most of what we of the correlations in our data, and it'll also be a bit more of an efficient representation. So I have a bit more I want to say, but I want to revisit PCA on Monday anyway, because it's going to be on the homework, so I have a bit more I want to say about it then. In any case, so I think I'll stop here, but I can take some questions. Yeah.
At what point in this are you like limited to linear correlation?
It's because here I'm saying that the new representation is just applying this matrix P, where P are kind of the what you're trying to find there. Does it answer your question? Or?
Yeah, I guess I just am envisioning like a lot of time, if you have like momentum and velocity, that's like a non-linear correlation, but right?
Like if you had momentum.
Redundant information there because your momentum is a function of your velocity, but it's not necessarily.
So you mean if like your components of X were, one was momentum and one was velocity?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If one was velocity and one was momentum, you know, like PCA. Like
if one was velocity and then the other one is just some factor times the velocity in the end?
Yeah.
Yeah, then this is, they're linearly related, right?
But is it, like, I'm thinking momentum is velocity squared.
If it's velocity squared, then, yeah, then they're not linearly. If you had something where the one variable is, I didn't erase it. Let me go back to my. So yeah, here the reason it can work well is because, I mean, X2 is essentially some linear factor times X1 in this case. If it was quadratic, then, I mean, it's not that you can't do something. Obviously, we still have some correlations, and we should be able to find a lower dimensional representation if it's perfectly quadratic. It's just that it won't be PCA. It'll be something else.
Are there, like, nonlinear variations of PCA?
So there's other methods, but the nice thing about PCA is that you get out these principal components that you can directly interpret. Like, it's going to tell you, oh, this is how you transform your initial directions into these new ones. There's other methods that can detect more sophisticated correlations. So in that sense, I guess they're kind of like, you could say a generalization of PCA, but you kind of lose the interpretability. So in the homework, we're going to show that you're going to be able to apply this to an icing model, and you're going to be able to really understand what it's learning. Like, you'll be able to interpret that. But for other methods, you kind of lose that interpretability factor. So even though this method suffers that it can't find everything, it's nice in the sense that you can really understand what it's doing. Any other questions?